From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 Chai FM.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the show on this Monday morning. Hope that you are doing very, very well out there. It's a slightly more pleasant Monday morning. Last week was very, very cold and not so much fun. So it's shaping up and looking like a nice one. So I hope you're enjoying it out there. And we're certainly enjoying it in here. We're going to be giving you the best possible show that we possibly can, as we always do. What are we going to talk about? Well, later on the show, we're going to be talking about a very pleasant, nice, just a good news item about an interfaith initiative with a Catholic church in the Judean Hills. So that's going to be one. We're going to be talking about the tariff issue that has come through over the last few days and why it is that South Africa is paying a premium for its political preferences. We're also going to be talking about the issue of aid in Gaza and how is it being distributed and what is going on, because last week was a big part of the news cycle. And we're also going to be chatting about, and in fact starting with, the question of free speech in Australia and what is going on there. So that is what's coming up in the show. As always, if you want to be part of the conversation, we will be happy to take any of your views and ideas and anything else, really, criticisms, epiphanies, really whatever you want. We take it all on the show. So if you like that and you would like to be a part of it, 0618951019. That's 0618951019. And you can be part of the conversation and be part of what we are doing here.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. And I thought we'd start the show in a completely different place to where we normally do. I would rather start, we've done it already, but our first story, we were talking about the question of free speech in Australia. Now, I'm sure that Howard or Paula will be covering the story, if they haven't already, of these mass demonstrations against Israel in Australia, in Sydney, over the weekend. You had somewhere between 90,000, according to the Australian police, the organizers say 300,000 people marching over the Sydney Opera House Bridge in a show of anti-Israel strength. And among this, we had, among the protesters, we had ISIS flags, Al-Qaeda flags, people who were calling for people to be thrown out of Israel, thrown out of Australia. And this was at this particular march today, yesterday. So that was a big issue in Australia in the last while. And of course, we've seen Australia, which really for a very long time was seen as a very kind of pro-Israel country, supportive of Israel in the general populace. And we've seen this explosion of anti-Israel hate, anti-Jewish hate. We've seen the firebombing of synagogues and shuls. At the October 8th and 9th at the Sydney Opera House, you had people chanting "Gas the Jews" and all of the stuff that was coming out at this time. And so Australia has really been in the sort of front line of some of the stuff that we've seen in the Western world. Australia has been exemplifying it, and in the last couple of days, that's been precisely it. Some of this comes as a fact because the government there is a sort of centre-left government. The foreign minister is particularly poor. The prime minister is not great. So all of these are at the governmental level driving this question, and unfortunately, it's being echoed across the Western world, and an issue we're going to talk about in a minute, on the question of the aid issue. Unfortunately, we're seeing the results of what happened in Canada election. Mark Carney, who was never considered a particularly good friend of Israel, is now showing that that is absolutely the case. And it would have been very good if our friend Pierre Poilievre had gotten in at a time like this, because I think the Canadians could have acted as a bulwark against the sort of Commonwealth countries, Australia, Britain, and Canada. Those are sort of the three. I think that we wouldn't have been seeing this if he had been in charge, and I think that that is, that one we can thank Donald Trump for as well. But we'll get to Donald Trump later on. But nonetheless, back to Australia. So this is where Australia is at. Now, of course, people are entitled to their free speech. That is something that Australia is a free society. You can say what you want. But the question always is the question of double standards, right? Free speech under what guise? And so that brings us to an activist in Australia called Drew Pavlo. If you don't know, he is on Twitter, and he is an activist. He's famous for his activism, not so much on Israel, but on the Chinese Communist Party, who are actually obviously Australia is very close to China. It's very concerned about what China might be able to do to Australia at a military level, a cultural level, and he is a big critic of the Chinese Communist Party, who have a terrible human rights record and have a history of undermining the democratic norms of Australia. So in order to do this, he went to in Brisbane, and he took a sign, and the sign said, "Nothing happened in June 4th, 1989, change my mind." So that's what the sign said. He had the sign, he put it up, it was handwritten. And of course, the sign is a reference to Tiananmen Square. So that was the crackdown in 1989 by the Chinese Communist Party on students who were protesting there. And since then, that's sort of what has been commemorated by activists around the world since that time. And it's officially something you can't talk about in China. So the Chinese government actually puts in place on its firewalls and on its social media apps, because you can't really use Twitter or anything like that in China. You have to use their own internal ones. And so any references to 1989 or Tiananmen Square or even other sort of even vaguer references are actually scrubbed off of the social media platform by the Chinese censors. So he was basically protesting this. So what happened for protesting this? Well, so he was actually arrested for doing so. And the reason for the arrest was that the Chinese consulate is inside some sort of a precinct, I gather, which is called the Elizabeth Street Mall. And apparently there is a rule that if you are doing political advertising, then you have to get permission from the Elizabeth Street Mall. That was what you had to do. And the mall said, no, well, this is a violation because you're inside the mall. And they said to him he had to go to the other side of the street if he wanted to carry on doing his protest, which he refused to do. And then he was arrested. He was arrested on two counts. First of all, for saying that he was basically undergoing a political campaign, and secondly, for refusing to listen to the police when they said that that they had to go. So the initial fine was $10,000 for having done this, which is sort of quite a lot. And then he actually appealed it, and now it has been upped to $23,000, and Mr. Pavlo is actually refusing to sign to pay the fine. $23,000 Australian dollars. I'm not even sure how much that is. Probably close on 100,000 rand, maybe a bit more than that. And so now he's actually refusing to pay, and is considering going to jail because he's saying he can't pay. And there's people who will actually cover him, and he's saying he doesn't want their money. And he's refusing to pay, and he's potentially going to jail. Now, I don't want to say that Mr. Pavlo is being entirely innocent here. If he had done his protest apparently on the other side of the street, the authorities would have had much less of a leg to stand on, and so he's clearly is provoking something here, which is fine. And also at the time he was running for re-election, so you know the mall does have some sort of a vague argument to say that he was running a political campaign. But nonetheless, you know, basically what he did was violate a marker. And I just wanted to contrast it with what we're seeing in the Sydney Opera House. So a guy outside the Chinese consulate marks and calls on recognition effectively for what happened at Tiananmen Square, and gets a 23,000 fine, but for threatening to kill Jews and waving ISIS flags, that's all right at the protest as far as Australia is concerned. And I think it's a very interesting contrast into how some of these laws are being applied. Free speech is free speech, but it definitely isn't being applied universally. And we've seen this in American college campuses as well, where in the last 10 years or 15 years, you could be thrown out for misgendering someone or putting on an incorrect costume or something like that, but calling for the globalizing intifada or something like that, or river to the sea, that's considered political free speech. So there's not actually one standard. And I think one of the things that Western democracies are going to have to figure out is what this actually looks like if they are going to take this stuff seriously going forward. Now, if you have a small business, think about this. Imagine you ran an amazing special offer, and imagine Chai FM told 125,000 people about it. Imagine we also posted your special offer on our social media platforms and listed you on our website. And imagine you could do all of this on a month-to-month basis. What would that be worth to you? Chai FM has a special stimulus package for small businesses, and you should get in touch to find out more. Email info@chaifm.com or send us a text at +27 61 85 1019. That's +27 61 85 1019, and we will call you. 101.9 Chai FM, 101 megahertz of building community businesses. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. I hope you are doing well this morning. And as always, if you do want to be part of the show, 061-895-1019, that is the WhatsApp line, and we are happy to take any of your comments, criticisms, and or compliments, if you have one, that would be nice, on a Monday morning. Now, let's talk about the big story that was in the news really this whole of last week, and it was a really big story all around the world, and that is the question of aid in Gaza and what is going on. And it's a very, very complicated issue, and I've tried to sit and break down the last week what is actually going on, because it's very difficult to actually get a handle on it. And so if you're looking for answers in the next segment, don't expect any. Just expect some as much facts as we've been able at the Chai FM team here to dig up on this issue. So the first important point, I think, to have a look at is a great article by a guy called Matty Friedman, that writes at the Free Press. And he's been writing effectively the same article for 10 years, which is about how badly information sources are produced, particularly in Israel. And he famously talked about how AP, which is one of the big international broadcasters, was used to drive anti-Israel narratives via Hamas, when they reported on wars previously. So this has been his traditional kind of rant that he goes on, and is interesting stuff. It's worth picking up and reading, because he goes into some of that. The reason why it's coming up is because Israel in this particular war hasn't allowed international journalists in, and it means that we don't have necessarily a great idea what's going on. And his article now that he's written argues that even if they were there, we wouldn't have a good idea about what's going on. And he says basically you've got the viewpoint of the IDF, you've got the viewpoint of the aid organizations, who have different viewpoints, so we'll get to that in a minute, the UN ones versus things like the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. And then you've got actual Hamas or Palestinian journalists who are feeding stories to the media via their channels. And so it's very difficult to get a good idea about what's going on in Gaza. And of course, we've seen, if you look go back to the Intifada, you'll see there that there were major stories that were broken during the Intifada, like the Al-Dura affair, where Israel was accused of shooting a Palestinian child, even though the child actually never died and was never shot. And that was basically as a sort of massive blood libel that went around the world, and there were others during that time as well. And so the point about this whole first part of this is that we don't have good information about what's going on, and especially not at the moment. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that since the beginning of the war, month in, we were hearing stuff, as we know, about genocide. That was before Israel had even dropped any bombs. Early on in October, you heard about genocide. You also heard about starvation. That came a month in. And so allegations that Gazans are starving are not new, and ones that have not really been taken all that seriously up till now because of what was going on. So, which you'll hear now. So that's the second point. The third point is that we know that there is enough food in Gaza for everyone to eat. That, in terms of volume, that is not a concern. And this time, you can triangulate the information sources, because according to the UN's own estimate, Gaza has, from about March, had 6 months worth of food inside that had been actually put in. Now, bear in mind that Israel put a blockade at some point for about 2 or 3 months since March and so aid hadn't been getting in for some time, but there was already enough food for the Gazan population. So for most of the war, what has been happening is you've had the UN and other groups basically bringing in food aid under the sort of jurisdiction of the IDF, and they have been sending their trucks in, and then the food goes into Gaza. But what has been happening is that the food has been gotten stolen by Hamas. It then gets taken by Hamas, hoarded, and then sold on the open market at inflated prices, which they use then to run their war machine. Again, this is not a conspiracy theory. The UN's own reports say that 85% of aid is of their trucks have been stolen or hijacked or whatever, and this has been a huge issue. And by the way, we know this is happening because it's also not a feature necessarily of this particular war. It happens in Sudan, it happens in other parts of Africa. Very often the UN has this problem where it gives out food and then that ends up going into the hands of people who are not helpful actors. So what all of this tells us is that there's no starvation in Gaza, and that's why in the last week you have, newspapers like the New York Times and newspapers here in South Africa actually having to rely on fake photographs of children being emaciated and saying that is from hunger, whereas actually it's from children who are sick from other diseases. So on the one hand, there's no starvation in Gaza, and the numbers tell us that that's the case. But where there does seem to be an issue, and from the data that we can do, is that there's a kind of sense of perhaps food insecurity, which is the best way that we can talk about it. And this seems to be stemming from a couple of places. The first is that essentially Israel cut off the aid supply, and the idea was to deal with this problem of
of Hamas stealing the aid, and they tried to take over the food distribution system. So basically what had happened is a private contractor came in, this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. It's run by Americans, protected by the IDF. And what has happened is that unlike the UN system, where they go to lots of small nodes and give food out, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has a lot of meals in two or three big strategic places, which are outside of the population centers of the main sort of cities and whatever in Gaza, where Palestinian civilians are. And then people can come every day to those places and get meals. So this has a couple of effects. The first is that it is a little bit far away for people to come, so it means that it's less safe for women and children to come, and it's a lot of young men who have to come and get it. So that's number one. Number two is they've put through a lot of meals. I think something like 90 million meals is the stat, which basically for the last few months, it's 1.5 meals a day for all the Gazans that are reliant on their aid. So it's food, but it's not as much food as you potentially could have. So that is a secondary problem. And the distribution mechanism is not as efficient, if you like, as the UN, because they're not tossing it directly into the hands of Hamas. And so this does seem to have affected the food system in Gaza. And we know this, the primary piece of data that's been used here is actually coming from Israeli sources. It's a team at the Hebrew University who basically have been trying to track the food situation using the price of flour in the markets there as a proxy. And effectively what the flour prices have suddenly done is rocket for some reason. And that means that Gazans who might not have jobs or some other means of employment are now struggling to buy the flour, which then can be used for food. So that is the issue. The key thing seems to be, particularly on the poorer side of Gaza, a lot of Gazans, like you'll see videos of restaurants and access to food, because not all Gaza is the same. You get wealthier, politically connected people. It's the same as any society. And so it's really on the poor end that there seems to be a little bit more of this kind of food insecurity. And the Israeli data is suggesting that it's become more difficult for them to get hold of cheap flour. And that may have something to do with how the distribution mechanism is working or not working. So that is on the case. And as a result, you've seen, along with the intense propaganda that you've seen around the fake pictures and all of this, and the reports coming out of food insecurity, you've seen the Israelis sort of having to go back to some of the old methods that they were using before, the dropping of things on the air, which is not very efficient, and to try and alleviate this hunger issue. The two other issues which are absolutely crucial here is the first is that the UN has basically stopped cooperating at all. The GHF basically always had this idea that they would work with the UN with this new model, but the UN has an incentive for the GHF model not to work. And so they've not been cooperating not being very supportive, and that has brought down the amount of aid that is coming in general. That is the one big issue. The other big issue, of course, is the hostages. And we've heard testimony from hostage families that, as well as torture, that the hostages were starved deliberately during their time in prison. And hostages have said that they had only two spoonfuls of cheese along with a piece of pita a day as part of their food. And we saw these horrific images coming out of Gaza of hostages that Hamas decided to release now of all times, which is very interesting. An interesting calculation. Not quite sure why in the middle. But it shows you that there has been deliberate starvation of hostages this entire time. And that Hamas is really responsible for not just that, but for stealing the aid as well. So that is the situation. Where this goes from now, I'm not sure. But that is the best that we've been able to piece together for you here on 101.9 High FM.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Are you looking for delicious Mediterranean delicacies? Look no further than the original Friends Bakery in Sandringham. Our mouth-watering selection includes sabras, pitas, shawarma, falafel, pastries and burekas. We even cater for special occasions and offer delivery straight to your door. And on Fridays, we serve up exotic Shabbos dishes that will leave your taste buds dancing. Don't wait. Come into our store at 17 Ann Street in Sandringham or give us a call on 076 108 0085 to place your order today. The original Friends Bakery, where every bite is a taste of heaven.
Why should you choose First? We are in the business of dealing with people, and property is our product. First Realty is synonymous with professionalism, trust, and integrity. Cutting-edge technology and diverse marketing platforms allow for maximizing success for our clients in the shortest possible time frame. Our services cover commercial, industrial, and residential sales and rentals, as well as property auctions in the Greater Johannesburg North. We are big enough to make a difference and small enough to care. At First, we have clients for life, and we invite you to be one of them.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
Dischem Wellness Clinic for Adults offers you convenient and professional care to help manage your health risks. Whether you are having your regular wellness checks, such as blood pressure or cholesterol, Dischem Wellness Clinics offers you a broad range of health screening services, including female health screening with pap smears, family planning, and pregnancy screening. Fast, affordable, and with care, find your nearest Dischem Wellness Clinic inside. Dischem Pharmacies, better health starts here. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM. Hope that you are doing very, very well. And if you have any questions or comments during the show, feel free to send us a WhatsApp, and we'll happily take on board what you have to say. So that is 0618951019. That is our WhatsApp line, 0618951019. And we can chat to you and see what is going on, because we love hearing from our listeners. Absolutely. Now, what to talk about? Let's talk about this trade regime that we have that has exploded upon us from Trump in the last few days. Which is sort of official, but still under negotiation, as Trump always likes to do. I don't know how long he thinks he can carry this on, because at some point, I think it's going to start affecting the American economy. It's a big economy, but you can't fiddle with everything all the time and go back and forth. People need to plan things. But as far as South Africa is concerned, we got hit with a tariff rate of 30%. That's sort of the final number that seems to have come about. And what's important about that is that up till now, we've seen commentators in South Africa say, look, there's nothing to see here, don't worry about it. You know, Trump is just doing this to everyone, so there's nothing that we can do. And partly that, of course, is true. Trump has been putting tariffs on all countries, and the Americans are trying to recalibrate the trade regime in the world. Quite why that's the case, I'm not sure. Basically, Trump's logic seems to be that they don't like the way in which the deficit, the amount of goods and services that America is trading is being dealt with, and therefore the Americans are paying out a lot for this. Look, in some cases, some countries are demanding free access to the American economy whilst having big trade barriers themselves. So the one, India, the EU, are both on that list. And so in some cases, it is just a rebalancing where Trump is going to say, look, we're not allowing you to have free goods into our space if you're going to make us pay for yours, which, you know, there's sort of economic arguments even against that approach, which, you know, maybe we need to get Pumlani Mojozi on to discuss that with us in general. But in the meantime, what we have is the South African one, right? If you look at African countries, even a bunch of other European countries, Brazil, whatever, you find that South Africa is actually very high up. There have been some countries that have higher tariffs than us, like Syria, but there's actually like also proper trade embargoes for other things. And there's some European countries that have been having tiffs with Trump over medical licenses. So they've got high things. But if you look at Africa in general, most countries in Africa actually have quite low tariffs comparatively. So it was like 10% up. I'm hoping that I haven't seen the one for Lesotho, but I hope that they had a slightly less tariff because, excuse me, they sort of, the economy was very much focused on exporting to the US, and when they, I think they got like 50%, and that was ridiculous. But what happened with most countries is that they actually ended up with a sort of 10% rate, and we ended up with 30%. And so that, by the way, is up from about 2% that it normally is. So that's the case sort of in general. But the question is, why are we being added to the 20%? Because people like Ridi Klami, who you'll see on Twitter or on various newspapers, is part of this chorus that says, no, there's nothing to see, it's just South Africa. But yet we have this higher tariff than everybody else, certainly on the continent, and actually globally we're tariffed higher. And that is a political risk premium that we're paying, right? If you saw the Afrikaans groups that went to America just a while ago, they sort of came back with four demands. Number one, looking at farm murders as a serious offense. Number two, something to do with amending EWC. Number three, amending BEE in some way. And number four, some sort of condemnations of kill the Boer and whatever. And I would add to that, although it wasn't official, but I suspect it's part of it, is also some movement on our international relations to be sort of more in the democratic camp. And of course, we've seen a debate around the BEE. We've covered this in the program before. And even now, actually, the ANC is saying, well, you know, the BEE, we're not going to get rid of it, but we might change it. So there has been a shift in the conversation, but there hasn't really been a shift in any of the other aspects of it. And on the international relations front, has actually gotten worse. So we're seeing, for example, there was this thing the other day, which was this Hague group. These are countries that are targeting Israel for boycotts of ships and whatnot. We saw that the South African government has basically downgraded its relationship with Taiwan and is trying to kick the Taiwanese out of Pretoria. And as a result, Taiwan has actually is actually saying that it's not going to supply us semiconductors, which is a big issue, or it might not affect us directly. And that is sort of a big issue with them and us. Although we should be able to get the semiconductors from somewhere else if we push hard enough. But basically, what this 20% actually represents is a change in the structure, And the 20% that we're paying is the political risk premium that we're paying for not changing our policies as they affect South American businesses, and how we react as foreign policy. And the sooner we can do that, the sooner we can have a change in these policies, which are affecting our farmers and are affecting our motor vehicles and a bunch of other things. So that is a huge process, and there we go. I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM, and Mike Lubo, thank you so much for your message. it seems to have slipped through the cracks there a little bit, and we were just talking at one point about how much is an Australian 23,000 Australian dollars. I thought it was 100,000. Turns out it's closer to 250,000. So thank you for that. Also, thank you to we have an anonymous Louis Benjamin. Thank you, and he actually has shared a very helpful GIF from Kogat, who deals with the food coming into Gaza, and you can actually get Kogat sources, he says, which actually show you the amount of aid going in and out. So that is something that you can look at. So thank you so much to everyone who was involved with that discussion. So just before we end off, we end off on a slightly lighter note. So there is a Catholic monk mission in Israel, in the Judean hills, and they are from a type of monk, a kind of monk called Le Trappe, or the Trappists, they're known as. And their viewpoint on life is that you can be a monk, but you also have to work. And so they had their monastery, and there were about 10 or 20 monks, and they would actually plant vineyards and have olive trees, which they would make olive oil out of, the olives that came out of the tree. And this is how they would work to pay for the mission and pay for themselves. And they didn't just rely on handouts from the Catholic Church to operate. And it's an interesting, because obviously monks, generally speaking, are kind of monastic, and they study all day, but here they were actually working. And unfortunately, they had a big problem, because of course you had those fires that broke out in the last while, which burned through all sorts of agriculture and playgrounds and parts of Israel. And so this monastery actually was affected by the fires, and their olive trees and their vineyards were actually destroyed. And so an interfaith initiative helped out, and they reached out to some Israelis, and now they have 80 Israelis who are actually volunteering at the monastery, and they are helping to replant the vines and help the olive trees. And apparently it's not such hard work, but it is, you know, Israel's hot in the summer, and so it's a bit rough. And so 80 Israelis have gone out to help this Catholic monastery to replant their vineyards and replant their olive trees and groves, so that they can get back on their feet and do what they do best, which is being monks and tending to their gardens, so that they can make the money that they need to survive. And you know, in an age where we have so much animosity, I think that these sorts of initiatives are really important to make sure that everyone remembers that we're all human at the end of the day, and at the end of the show. So that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to the whole team who puts everything together, Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons, Vusi's on the sound, and to you, dear listener, who joins us every single week, to join us again next week on the New Blue Review.